Welcome to this summer season's Breaking the Ice. This summer, we'll be diving into discussions on the people and politics around the Arctic. My name is Leonie, and I'll be your host for this season of Breaking the Ice. Join us as we delve into the big issues facing the Canadian North and the whole of the Arctic region.
Okay, so thank you, Sarah, for joining us today. You're actually the first one out the gate of this summer's podcast series called Breaking the Ice. We are Arctic 360. We're Canada's premier Arctic think tank. And we're really delighted to have you. I will be a co-host today. My name is Jessica Shadian. I'm the president and CEO of Arctic 360. And my co-host partner will be Leonie Rising. And she's basically our summer monk intern. And so we're really happy to have Leonie with us working on our podcast for this summer. So for those who do not know, Sarah Olsvig, who is quite known, in fact, around the Arctic. She's currently the international chair of the Inuit Circumpolar Council. She's also served as a member of parliament for Denmark in Denmark from 2011 to 15, and also the parliament of Greenland from 2013 to 2018. She's also been the leader of the Greenlandic political party, IA, and vice premier and minister of social affairs, families, gender equality, and justice in the government of Greenland from 2016 to 18. She's also served as the chair of the Standing Committee of Parliamentarians of the Arctic Region, and Sarah is currently a PhD candidate at the university there in Greenland, and I hope it goes without saying that Sarah is Greenlandic herself. And so, Sarah, we're really happy to have you here today to basically discuss all things ICC, Arctic Council, intergovernmental and Arctic affairs. So thank you very much. And maybe I will turn it over to Leonie.
So thank you again for joining us. Could you share some initial thoughts and highlights about your recent appointment as ICC chair?
Well, ICC, the Inuit Circumpolar Council, is very, very dear to my heart as an organization. I used to work for ICC back, I would almost say in the day, when I was a student studying anthropology in Copenhagen. I went to some of the negotiations in Geneva leading up to the finalization of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and also during the first meetings that established the expert mechanism on the rights of Indigenous Peoples in Geneva. So already as a relatively young student, I got engaged in the work with ICC, especially on the human rights side and the UN side. And I worked for ICC from the years 2005 and until I became an elected member of parliament in 2011, first as a student help and later as a full-time employee here at the office in Greenland. So I have, for all of my both academic and political career, had different kinds of relations to the Inuit Circumpolar Council. As you probably know, our chairship terms goes 4 years and rotates between Greenland, Canada, and Alaska. And I was very humbled when ICC Greenland nominated me as incoming chair in early 2022. And when I was elected at the General Assembly, and hopefully we will be able to do a good job for these 4 years. Now 1 year has passed, and we are very, very busy. And of course, it's in the middle of a time that is challenging for the whole of the Arctic, and likewise also for the Inuit Circumpolar Council. So we are working hard and working a lot, especially because we have our delegates meeting coming up just in 10 days' time.
Yeah, and you also mentioned briefly that the ICC represents the Inuit in Alaska, Canada, Greenland, and Russia. Can you give us a brief rundown on some of the priority areas?
Yes. So the Inuit Circumpolar Council was established in 1977. So that was during the Cold War. And there was a big sort of move and push for us amongst ourselves, amongst Inuit, to actually unite in an organization to sort of erase those state borders that were imposed on our land when colonization came. We speak more or less the same languages across Inuit Nunat, and we understand each other, and we clearly are from the same people and the same culture. That is something that is very, very, very tangible when we meet. And that's why we look so much forward to meeting this summer, since last summer we didn't meet in person. So when those first meetings were held in 1977, when we read the records of that, it was a really big historical thing for Inuit to actually unite in one organization. And obviously back then, it was not possible from day one to include Inuit from Chukotka. ICC Chukotka was only formally included in ICC in 1992 after the end of the Cold War. So it has taken many years, and ICC has been existing as an organization for 46 years and has built a very strong foundation in regards to being recognized in different international fora, having first of all the UN ECOSOC accreditation as an NGO since 1983, and thereby participating directly in all UN work that relates to the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, but also many other things in the UN. And also, of course, being a co-founder and one of the three first permanent participants in the Arctic Council from 1996. So there's a lot of very strong platforms that ICC has built based on being an Indigenous Peoples organization that gathers Inuit from across Inuit Nunat. We represent about 180,000 Inuit. That's the number we get when we ask our branches how many Inuit live in your part of Inuit Nunat. There's obviously more Inuit in the world. Many Inuit live in diaspora outside of our homeland, like many Greenlanders live in Denmark. So the number might be bigger than 180,000, but as many other Arctic Indigenous peoples, we are not so many, but nevertheless, we have a strong organization in the Inuit Circumpolar Council.
And while you operate beyond state borders, given the different domestic realities in circumpolar countries, would you say that the Inuit in these different countries have differing perspectives on Arctic issues, and how does the ICC manage potentially competing perspectives?
Well, obviously the Inuit Circumpolar Council consists of many, many different organizations. For example, in ICC Greenland, we have 18 delegates, and these delegates, they represent a long range of different civil society organizations, from the Fishermen and Hunters Association, the Teachers Union, the Workers Union, the Human Rights Council, and so on. So we consist of many, many different organizations, and in Canada and Alaska and Chukotka, they also have different structures, different constituencies within their organizations. So combined as an Inuit Circumpolar Council with four member branches, we represent a very diverse group of organizations and in fact also very diverse peoples across Inuit Nunat being united in one organization. So that has been a balance all the way through the 46 years of Inuit Circumpolar Council's existence and will continue to be so. What makes us strong as an organization is that we always find a way to find a common ground and have very strong declarations that make up our mandate for the term, like the declaration we have from the General Assembly of 2022, where we have very clear priority areas that are common for Inuit across Inuit Nunat. For example, the infrastructure deficit across Inuit Nunat, or for example, the need for our participation in any marine governance as a marine people, or the health and well-being of our people, and so forth. So we negotiate declarations that are adopted, have always in the latest years been adopted unanimously, like the one from last year, which is our mandate now. And that is our clear guideline for working throughout the term. And this delegates meeting coming up in 10 days, we will focus on five of those priority areas to further develop our work plans together with our delegates.
Perfect. Okay, so This is a really nice backgrounder. And so why don't we turn our attention a bit to kind of basically the elephant in the room? So I think since its origin, since ICC's founding, since the Arctic Council came into being, we're really at a point right now that's different from the past. And so, the Arctic Council's, as you've said, it's occupied a really big space for ICC and the activities and priorities for ICC. And so just maybe if you can give us some sense of what your thoughts about what's happening right now in the Arctic and more broadly, but specifically on the kind of current state of affairs for the Arctic Council.
Yes, I think that we are in a situation that is, of course, unprecedented. We have had crises before, and as I said, Inuit Circumpolar Polar Council came out of a time that was the Cold War, and the situation of having the Iron Curtains was a situation that Inuit were and are familiar with. And I think that it would actually have been kind of naive to think that we wouldn't reach challenges similar to the Cold War again in the group of states that make up the Arctic Council with the indigenous peoples around the seat. So I think that what we see in the way that we have collectively states and indigenous peoples organizations tried to do in making sure that there is still an Arctic Council, and we did have an Arctic Council meeting on May 11th, is to focus on what the value of the Arctic Council is for Arctic peoples. And that has actually been the basis of why the Arctic Council was established in the first place, as we see it, to always focus on this being a collaborative or a body of collaboration that is there first and foremost for the Arctic peoples, with the full and effective participation of Arctic indigenous peoples. So to bring the focus to that, I think, has been detrimental in the ability of the 14 of us, so 8 states and 6 Arctic indigenous peoples organizations, to actually still come together around now not a real physical table, but come together and for example, agree on a joint statement and also agree on still having an Arctic Council. But the starting point of everything is, as I see it, that we unfortunately have to expect that it will not and would not be easy to have a collaboration among such different states and peoples that constitute the Arctic. So I think that we are in a relatively positive place right now with the situation taken into account, the overall world situation. And I think that when I listen to both states and other Arctic indigenous peoples, there is a will to continue some kind of a collaboration across the Arctic. It's important for me to say, as I also stated a few minutes ago, that we predate the Arctic Council as organizations, the Inuit Circumpolar Council, but also the Sami Council and others, and that our collaboration, of course, will continue because we represent peoples that live across state borders. So that is, I think, a very important point to remember when thinking about and working with Arctic diplomacy and Arctic governance.
Before I think I'm going to turn it over to Leonie, but I just have one follow-up question. So because you mentioned the May meeting, and so that was when Norway took over the chairmanship for the Arctic Council from Russia. And I guess, was there discussions during that time about, because you talked about going forward, continuing the collaboration. So were there specific details about how to and when to, or whether or not to engage with Russia?
That I cannot say so much about. I can just say that we as a people representing Inuit who live across Inuit Nunat, including in Chukotka, Russia, we, of course, as an organization still exist and we are still united. And we, it is in our interest and in our, it's our concern to maintain some kind of line of communication and relation, human relation, people-to-people relationship, cross-border cooperation with our fellow Inuit in Chukotka. That relationship has been built over decades after having lost much of the communication, and we are doing what we can to maintain the line of communication with our members in Chukotka. And that is important for us because we have seen for those years where our cooperation has been possible and relatively openly been, you know, able to be conducted relatively openly, how much we have gained across Inuit Nunaat from being united, from learning from each other, both in terms of language, of livelihoods and culture and traditions, indigenous knowledge that we share across Inuit Nunaat. For us, it is a, it is an invaluable thing to actually be in contact with each other and being able to support each other in whatever way is possible in relation to the work that we do in the Inuit Circumpolar Council.
Yeah, and just turning back to the Inuit in Chukotka and the new geopolitical landscape that we find ourselves in, how has the Russian invasion of Ukraine affected your ability to work with ICC Russia and the Inuit in Russia more generally?
Well, it's safe to say that there's no business as usual at this point in the way that we work with the Inuit in Chukotka. And I want to just express my deep concern for their situation in regards to their safety also. So I don't have much to say about how exactly we do things internally in ICC, but just say that they are still members of the Inuit Circumpolar Council, and we do what we can, taking into account their personal safety, of course, to include them in the work that we do. But it's not business as usual, and has not been business as usual since February 24th and 2022, and we are hoping that we in the future will be able to engage fully again.
And I think you mentioned something when we were talking earlier about the last meeting you have and this upcoming meeting.
Yes. Our General Assembly.
Yeah.
Well, we, as said, we have a 4-year terms with a rotation of the chairship. It has until now and probably will continue for a while been a chairship that rotates between Greenland, Canada and Alaska. So every 12th year one of the branches take over the chairship, and Greenland took over in 2022, and our meeting was held as a hybrid meeting in 2022. The reason for that was actually the COVID, that there was still a threat of COVID spreading at different places in Inuit Nunaat. And so very early on, before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, it was decided that we would have our meeting as a hybrid meeting. But our delegates mandated us to hold an in-person delegates meeting this year, July 2023. So that will happen and start in Ilulissat, in Disko Bay, here in Greenland. And here we will meet to discuss five of our priority areas. And we will also, during the week, have an Arctic Peoples Conference, inviting and welcoming other Arctic Indigenous peoples, co-hosting it together with the Sami Council, to discuss Arctic cooperation in a broader sense. And that will be a commemorative conference of the first Arctic Peoples Conference that was held in 1973. So we are also celebrating the 50 years of Arctic Indigenous Peoples cooperation when we meet in Ilulissat in 10 days.
And so for that meeting, will the Russian Inuit participate virtually or not won't be able to participate
in our delegates meeting? Yes, in our delegates meeting we will have ICC Chukotka participate virtually.
Okay, Great. So taking kind of what you're just saying and building off that a bit and broadening it back out, with all this, you know, it's kind of been a lot of kind of sitting in flux, right? It's a right now the Arctic Council in general is an institution a bit in flux, but that's also provided kind of a moment where we could say, okay, well, maybe it's at a crossroads. We can, you know, reflect on the successes and what the Arctic Council has accomplished so far, and thinking about going forward into the future. So my question actually for you, it's a two-part question. And one would be, do you think that there is a need or a potential for the Arctic Council to in some way better support the permanent participants than in terms of the structure that already exists? Or even just, you know, Inuit communities more generally, let's say. And then the second part of the question is, you know, talk to other some other Arctic state, non-Arctic states that are observers to the Arctic Council, and they've expressed in more than one setting that they would like to have basically a bigger role within the Arctic Council and even with more authority. And so the second part of my question is, you know, well, do you have any thoughts then about, you know, so maintaining the best balance where we, you know, member states and permanent participants, and then the role of the observers should play, et cetera. So.
Mm. Well, the first part of the question on the Arctic Council, I think that the Arctic Council from the outset and also in the early days of the Arctic Council, it was very, very clear that the Arctic Council was first and foremost there for the Arctic peoples. And I think the Arctic Council would not have been the council that we know today, and the work that is actually done in the working groups and on different projects and so on would not have been the work that we have seen being done and the results reached if Arctic Indigenous peoples had not participated in that work. So we have to remind ourselves constantly, especially in this situation, what the value of the council is for Arctic peoples and especially Arctic Indigenous peoples. And I think that is actually what we are reminding ourselves, and we are reminded of when we are in this situation, because it has been difficult and probably will be difficult still to make sure that the work is actually done in the way that it has been done previously. So there's one side of it, which is a side of it that is about reminding each other of the value of the Arctic Council as it is, but also not forgetting that the Arctic Council pre-invasion of Ukraine was not perfect. So there's of course space for improvement. And I think that we have come, regardless of the world situation right now, we have come to a time in history, both in research in general, but also in the way governance is done, where we have to reevaluate how we are doing things. Talking specifically about research, I see a lot of our universities and young students and processes within our universities that is focusing on how do we turn around the role of research in a situation of being peoples and nations that were colonized, partly through research. So how do we make sure that the research that is done today is done with the equal participation and with the full and the equitable participation of the peoples that the research is about, or their lands, or their resources, or the climate around them, and so on. So I'm very, very happy, and I think it's such a very good development to see that several universities are developing new ethical guidelines and ethical protocols, like the ones we've done in ICC on equitable and ethical engagement. I think that is a very key thing, and something that was already in a process in the Arctic Council for several years. And I think that process we have to continue also in the Arctic Council, to look back at, okay, all of our working groups and the scientific work that is done, do we actually include Indigenous knowledge on an equal footing? Do we actually make sure that the projects that are done through the Arctic Council are first and foremost based on research questions and research designs that we want in the Arctic, that we find interesting in the Arctic? So in that sense, I think that we collectively in the Arctic Council, regardless of the current situation, had and have a challenge that we should meet constructively and with interest and with the focus on how we can improve even more the already very strong and good work and collaboration that is done through the machinery of the Arctic Council, which is the working groups. And there, I think that, as I said, it wouldn't have been what it is today if Arctic Indigenous peoples had not been at the table and participated fully in this work. So yes, I think that the collective Arctic Council has a big task and a responsibility to making sure that the permanent participants and the organizations that make up the permanent participants have the capacity and have the access to participate fully in all of the work. And this, of course, also comes down to the parliaments and governments of the different nations and states in the Arctic to actually fully support the organizations that make up the permanent participants. For the Inuit Circumpolar Council, this is a constant push that we have through time towards the governments and parliaments in our homelands. And I'm very happy to see that we are actually supported. And in the recent years, we have also seen an increase of the support for our work. And that has made it, you know, we are now in a little bit of a better situation than we were for just 2 years ago in regards to being able to actually do the work and participate. But we have a long way to reach the point where we fully engage on a level that we would have liked to. And I think it will be a win-win for everyone if we collectively make sure that our organizations can actually participate fully in the work that is done.
Absolutely. If I recall correctly from my own research, actually, so the issue on research goes as far back as the origins of the ICC, and that was a really important issue for them in establishing kind of that precedent for the need for collaboration and inclusion of Inuit. And so maybe some of those ethics, you know, pieces that we see in research today, we can trace those back to kind of the early work of the ICC. Great, and I was going to mention one thing. And you're talking about the early days in terms of Inuit participation in the formation of the Arctic Council, and just on the Canadian side, that's where, you know, Mary Simon played a really big role and a huge advocate for ensuring that Indigenous people have a real fundamental role on the council itself. I think Canada was even pushing for voting, right? Now it's census based, but to have like an actual vote. So.
Yeah. And I think that is also something that we as Arctic Indigenous peoples should discuss. And we will be discussing that at the upcoming Arctic Peoples Conference, what our role in a future Arctic Council should be. And what I also wanted to say is that the fact that Arctic Indigenous peoples had already met as early as the early 1970s and that we had formed our organizations also meant that when states joined the idea of having a circumpolar body, we were ready to engage. So I think that a lot of the sort of historical development of Arctic governance, we should not forget and or undermine the role that Arctic Indigenous peoples have played in making that happen. Of course, the will of the states have also been central and still is today, but there's been a foundation to work on the basis of because the cross-border collaboration across the Arctic among Indigenous peoples was already being built.
Yep, and creating this kind of almost like, you know, political sphere that is the Arctic, right? So, and it so much predates the Arctic Council itself. I'll turn it over to Leonie, but...
Yeah, and thinking beyond the Arctic Council and the states, do you see other fora that can help fill the gap to accommodate and promote activities of Arctic Indigenous peoples?
Yeah, well, that's also another thing that has happened over these decades, right? That we have one after the other of international organizations that do work and engage and are Arctic. So as we see with the Inuit Circumpolar Council, our previous leadership pushed for our provisional consultative status, for example, in the International Maritime Organization. We also hold an observer status in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We engage in various kinds of of UN negotiation processes, climate COPs, the UNFCCC, and also the work that is being done in regards to biodiversity beyond national jurisdiction. And also, as most recently, the development with the Central Arctic Ocean's Fisheries Agreement, where we as Inuit participate through the state delegations. So there are, today we have a long list of different ways of engaging in internal processes, bringing the voice of Inuit to those processes and fully and firmly doing that on the basis of us contributing with knowledge that we think will strengthen the process and the result. So I think that the sort of the governance tradition that have been built in the Arctic has been used and transferred into other governance bodies that are not necessarily only Arctic. Some of them are not. And I think that that is a really important development that Indigenous peoples from around the world have collectively ensured, but certainly also Arctic Indigenous peoples have been taking part in paving the way for. So I think that the development, again, going back to what people might call decolonization or might call shifts in paradigm of how we think of the world, I think we have a collective responsibility and a challenge to hold on to those ways of doing international governance, where we include peoples that are not necessarily states. So that's a challenge, and that's a really exciting development. And one of the things that I'm very excited about is the process within the UN, which is about the enhancement of the participation of Indigenous peoples in the UN, where Indigenous peoples from around the globe have gathered in what is called the Indigenous Coordinating Body. We are also members of that from the Inuit Tsleil-Waututh Council together with the Sami Parliamentary Councils. And here we are collectively pushing for the establishment of a new category within the UN where Indigenous peoples' own representative institutions can have a voice and a seat in the UN. And we see some positive development on that. The Human Rights Council under the UN held an expert seminar in November last year, and we had an interactive dialogue with the President of the General Assembly of the UN during the permanent forum session in April this year. So I am seeing that the broader world outside of the Arctic is also concerned and also engaged in finding ways to fully engage Indigenous peoples in our own rights as nations in international negotiations. And I think that is a historical and important development that we should not close our eyes to in the Arctic, especially at this point of time where Arctic governance is challenged.
Absolutely.
Continuing on from that with the work of the UN, so you already mentioned that the ICC is extremely active, and also the UN Convention on the Law of the Seas and the issues of the Northwest Passage. Do you think that the ICC has a role or space for a role to play to advocate for Inuit rights? Is it something that you're already working on, or would it be more specific to ICC Canada?
No, all of the international work is done as an international organization. So all the work that we do from each of the branches is ICC's work, the Inuit Circumpolar Council's work. And then we have every time we have a General Assembly, we also make sure that we divide the different files. And ICC Greenland has for a long time worked very much with the UN and human rights files. ICC Canada has worked very much with the marine governance files. And the ICC Alaska, for example, has worked very much with the food security and food sovereignty files. So in that way, we are utilizing all of the resources that we have across Inuit Nunat. But the work that we do on the international level is always on behalf of Inuit Circumpolar Council, which then consists of four member branches, right? So I think that what we can say about the UNCLOS is that the UNCLOS itself was not developed together with Indigenous peoples. We see now that other processes are being developed with the participation of Indigenous peoples, and we insist on being there at the table. We insist on having our voice heard, and we insist on that having learned from those processes where we were not included. So I think that the development we are seeing in these years, where some doors are opening a little bit for our participation, of course there's still challenges, but those like slightly open doors, they are really also an expression of the world around us recognizing and understanding the importance of our inclusion. So what we see, for example, with the Central Arctic Oceans Fisheries Agreement, I think it's a strong, strong development that we from the outset have Indigenous peoples at the table. The same with the work in the IMO, that there is actually a willingness to include us with, although it's a provisional consultative status, but actually listen to us. And the same in the IPCC and so forth. So it's a constant push. But I think that what the world can expect is that we are not not gonna care. We are always going to care about the marine environment and marine governance around us, because it is directly about our livelihoods and our cultural and in any other way well-being. So I think that this is an expression of Inuit exercising our inherent right of self-determination whenever we go and insist on participating. And I think that it's a point that is important to remember for anyone engaged in governance or science or research across the Arctic and Inuit Nunat, is that we are there, and we are there because we are the peoples of the Arctic who have been there for millennia. And we will be exercising our inherent rights of self-determination. Those rights are not only there because they were written down and agreed upon in the UN in 2007. They are there because we as peoples exist, and we live our lives on the basis of being the peoples that we are. So that's the kind of shift in paradigm in the way of thinking that I'm talking about, that I see some developments actually being positive towards. Other developments not, so, but in the Arctic and on the different international platforms that we have participated in, there has been a positive development. But that, of course, also then makes it important for us to be able to continue to contribute and attend and participate.
You know, and also maybe you could tell me if I'm wrong, but there seems to also be a shift or a recognition where in early days there was a lot of discussion and people thought, well, ICC or Indigenous peoples were just another stakeholder. And I think people are starting to become aware, educated, and knowledgeable about the fact that, you know, this is something completely different. And it's just we all have to navigate a real new entity that's part of the international system, that's not a state, but is definitely just not a stakeholder. You know, it's an actual political entity that has a place, a seat at a table, and a legitimate voice. So I don't know if you disagree with that.
I think fully, yes. That's also taking me back to what I forgot to answer on the issue of observers in the Arctic Council. Yes, and I think that's where the distinction also has to be, put, that Arctic peoples consists of not only states, and those Arctic peoples who sit together currently in a structure that is consisting of 14 entities that make up the Arctic Council, is something to both protect and develop further on the basis of. And here I think that we are of course challenged with the Arctic Council on how to move forward in regards to observers. But I think that observers and those who are then not Arctic peoples or representative of Arctic peoples in one or the other way will have to be quite patient. So that we in the Arctic, who actually are Arctic peoples and represent Arctic peoples, can continue to build a strong foundation under that collaboration. So that would be my answer to the question of observers and their current role.
Yeah, which was good because I was hoping you would get back to that maybe as well. Okay, so I want to turn attention kind of specific to climate change for a while. Nye and I actually both wrote a longer op-ed about this. But we often hear, and rightly so, about, you know, Inuit being on the front lines of climate change. And in instances and in certain venues or by certain organizations, what's come out the other end of that is this idea that, you know, Inuit are basically anti-development and there should be, therefore no Arctic development, any kind of, Arctic development of any kind of resources or otherwise should not be possible, and often organizations speak on behalf of Indigenous peoples about this very issue. But we also know that, in particular, when we're talking, as you mentioned, about infrastructure, other types of investments that could very likely include the private sector, for banks, for instance. These kind of investments for various development projects are needed. So Inuit communities can have strong economies, because strong economies are really what's needed for Inuit to be resilient to climate change, because this kind of goes back to the infrastructure piece. So I'm wondering how, because it's not been an easy one to navigate, and so how is ICC figured out how to get that balance right in terms of the discussions around, yes, vulnerability to the impacts of climate change, but Inuit need to have strong economies, investment in order to be able to be resilient?
Yes, I think it's important to say that the Inuit Circumpolar Council is not an environmental NGO. We are an Indigenous peoples organization that represent a people that wants to develop, that has an interest in developing, that with our holistic worldview, fully recognize and find important that our people have business development, infrastructural development, access to health services, access to education, access to transportation, and so on across Inuit Nunat. Our focus is on the decision-making processes. So for example, if you look at our Declaration on Responsible Resource Development, it's focused on the decision-making processes. And this is where we have the, for me, very exciting process of using the tools that we developed and negotiated and took part in negotiating on the international arena. For example, the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and actually implement it in the way that we do things in the Arctic and across Inuit Nunat. There we have still some steps to take and still some implementation to do. And I think that goes for all of our jurisdictions, and there are more than four, because for example, Greenland is its own jurisdictions on a long range of legislative areas. So for us, it's also a very complex issue to implement, for example, the UN Declaration or other human rights instrument that we participated in developing, or agreements. So I think that our focus has been for decades on decision-making processes, going back to the very foundation of having the right of self-determination. This is the exact challenge we also see, for example, in Sápmi, among the Sami people, where they work with a concept they call green colonization. That is specific to the development of windmills
wind turbines
across land that they use for reindeer herding, thereby losing the access to that land and not having taken part in the decision making. They call that green colonization. And when I'm asked to explain what I see green colonization as, it is for me when people that are not from the Inuit Nunat or that are not ourselves impose on us development in the name of something else. For me, that could both be different ways of adapting or developing green energy sources. It could also be because of security concerns. So I think that we at this time, in this time of history, we have a situation where our own states are actually also at a test on how they're going to implement the rights of Indigenous peoples in those decision-making processes. And I fully believe that it's in all of our interest to be very concerned with the issue of how to obtain and secure implementation of those fundamental rights in any development that we do in the Arctic. And it is especially important because we live in nations that have been, that were colonized. So we are peoples that have been through that, with all that comes with it, of different kinds of trauma, of different kinds of challenges. It is very tangible and real across Inuit Nunat, as we know. And therefore, in any other development we are seeing right now, we should all be concerned and make sure that we do it right. So To me, I think that this is closely related to climate change, because climate change is multiple layers of effects that affects directly us as peoples, both on a sort of meta governance layer, but also on a very, very, very tangible sort of day-to-day, in a day-to-day sense. It is changing the ecosystems around us. And although we, of course, as people have adapted over centuries and millennia, the changes are happening very, very fast now. And on top of that, with the global attention to the Arctic because of climate change, the global attention to resources in the Arctic, the global attention to possible shipping, to possible fisheries, and so forth. This is where we have to be very alert, not just as indigenous peoples, but also our states and governments.
Yeah. Just one quick follow-up and I'll turn it over to Leonie. But, you know, so it's interesting because sometimes in Canada, when, you know, we talk about green colonization, it's also, so it goes back to kind of, let's say, the IC Declaration on Sustainable Resource Development. It's been more focused on other entities or governments saying, no, you can't or can, you know, develop your whatever resource this is in the name of climate change. And so the argument is, well, that's for us to decide, because that's the heart of self-determination. And we have, these are our resources. And so it's not whether necessarily for or against, but more about having the power and ability and the governance mechanisms to be able to decide if and what and how resources should be developed. And so kind of this, you know, like arbitrary taking away of the ability to develop a certain resource in the name of climate change is seen, even if it's like, let's say like gas or something like that, is just seen as kind of green colonialism. You know, you polluted us and now we're now we have climate change here and now you're telling us that we can't do anything because...
Yes. And we have to remember that because we are an indigenous people who live differently than the majority of the world's population, for example, the issue of seals. So you banned seal products, right. And you have to go through a long, long process to open up for an exemption for Inuit seal products that were from seals hunted by Inuit, right? So there will just be a constant pressure to the way that we live.
Yes.
And that's why I think it's so important to focus on those fundamental rights that we already have, which is first and foremost the right of self-determination, but also to participate in any decision making that relates to us, and so much decision making does on so many levels, and focusing on making sure that the free, prior, informed consent is obtained, that we have processes that ensure that both internally and externally. And so forth, because the pressure will probably not end very soon. We see it on almost any kind of resource development we want to do, be it living or non-living resources, because we are peoples that are few who have a very different culture than the mainstream world has around us.
Turning back international organizations and intergovernmental organizations. We've talked about many, but are there any that the ICC would like to see more involvement to help advance its mandate that we haven't mentioned?
Well, I think that those we have mentioned are the ones that we are focusing on. And I think that there's like sort of very general developments, for example, in the UN and the enhanced participation process that I mentioned. It's not something that is going to be implemented tomorrow. It will be a long process and a long haul, just like we saw it took 25 years to negotiate the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. What I think is important is that we continue to enjoy the support in that long haul, that we ourselves and also the ones, the partners and allies we have around us, that they also understand that sometimes things can take very, very long. But the point is that you keep attending and you keep participating and you keep having your voice heard and you keep taking that seat at the table, no matter if the seat is there or not for you. So I think that I would rather like to answer that in a more general term, a general sense, that I think it's a collective, it in the collective interest of the human species, actually, that the diversity we actually represent as indigenous peoples, taking our seats at the tables will only make the results and the processes better for the whole world. And we have seen it in so many different processes, how valuable it has been that indigenous peoples took part in negotiations. And I think that some of the movements we are seeing in the world right now, where people are starting to question what kinds of developments do we want to see, what constitutes, for example, well-being, what constitutes economic, sustainable economic development, what constitutes sustainability, and so on. Those processes are, as I see it, often very informed by worldviews coming from indigenous peoples. And I think that is the sort of development that we want to see in those different platforms that we engage in, which I think in the end is also going to enrich in the world, so to speak. And I think that especially from our side in the Inuit Circumpolar Council, our biggest challenge is the capacity. It is that we are actually able to have staff and have the funds and so on to build the programs and do the work that we want to do. So that is a constant sort of challenge that we keep doing what we can to meet. And that also requires us to prioritize very strictly what we engage in and what we do not engage in. We could definitely engage in many more things than we do right now. So it's always a priority.
So maybe picking up on that, I have one last question. I'm going to say just a few words. I think some of the key things that I hear you saying, perhaps a bit. And then Leonie has a really good final question that she would like to ask, to kind of round off our whole conversation. But so you're talking about needing to prioritize and be very specific and deliberate in where you put your energies. I'm wondering if, because we've talked a lot about, you know, UN Arctic Council and these kind of intergovernmental forums, you know, given like the reality of what's going on today, you know, so we don't just have like an Arctic geopolitics, we have global geopolitics that now very much is kind of almost consumed or that's taken the Arctic with it, I guess. And I'm wondering if you feel that there is an interest or a need for then maybe ICC to start having a seat at some of these kind of Arctic security discussions that we see taking place, whether it's like NATO, the European Security Council, NORAD modernization. Is it important because they do have a reflection on all the work of and efforts and realities of Inuit under which, you know, representing the ICC? Is there a space for that you think will ICC should be playing within this to be able to have a voice at the table?
It's definitely important to remember when we speak about the security development and the sort of the constant balance of the security dilemma is, are we militarizing further? Are we expanding the surveillance? What are we actually doing as states and as nations and governments in the Arctic? I think it's important to remember in that development that indigenous peoples, first and foremost, of course, have added to the concept of security, that the concept of security is broader than military security or geopolitical senses of what security is about. And that goes back in time. But it's likewise important to remember that that doesn't mean that indigenous peoples don't have policies or opinions or wishes to be taken into account and participate in decision making on the hard security issues. And if we look at the Inuit Circumpolar Council, as opposed to some of the other Arctic Indigenous Peoples organizations, our organization has had very clear policies on hard security issues right from the beginning. So, for example, with the Resolution 7711 from 1977, the founding meetings of the Inuit Circumpolar Council, the constant development of those policies, for example, also in the Inuit Arctic policy from 2010, which has a very clear section on both hard security matters, but also other kinds of security matters. So again, here, if entities and bodies such as NATO, such as other collaborative institutions that mostly focus on hard security, if they have the ability to include indigenous peoples, Inuit and others, in those processes, I also think that that will have an effect, a positive effect on how things are done. NATO especially is a body that thinks in states, and I don't know if they have the structure to be able to include those that are not states or governments in a sort of Westphalian sense. So that will also be a challenge, I think, for NATO. So I just want to say that it's important to remember that because we are indigenous, it does not mean that we only care or think about soft security issues. All that is related to the Arctic is related to us, including the hard security issues. And I think we bring to the table some perspectives that might not be brought to the table if only states are there. So that will be sort of my careful reply to that, taking into account that I, of course, know that this is these issues are difficult issues to deal with any governance body and any including us as a governance body. So I think that we have a very, very, very big common challenge ahead of us in making sure that we do not militarize more than necessary. And that requires extreme thoughtfulness and carefulness in how things are done. And that, of course, affects us directly as Arctic inhabitants and peoples of the Arctic.
Mm. And having a seat at the table is one way to ensure that. It's been interesting listening to this, you know, you and throughout this conversation. I came into Arctic politics, you know, being interested as a student, an academic in Arctic politics through the Inuit Circumpolar Council. So I spent many, back in 2003, I think I spent two, and since then I've spent a lot of my time looking at, and so at that time in 2003, we were really seeing a period in the world of intensifying collaboration and cooperation. You know, it was a big moment of globalization, and I was, you know, quite taken in with the way, and just going even back to even, you know, the whole decades, centuries, making that ended up with the Inuit Circumpolar Council itself. And I've always considered the Inuit Circumpolar Council a bit of a trailblazer and helping to kind of reorient and redefine, you know, sovereignty and power and, you know, processes for who is part of these governance processes and not. And, you know, and since that time, we've seen, I think, as a world, kind of a retrenchment of this real, you know, collaborative spirit in the world. And so we kind of see states becoming more statist and going away from this kind of global cooperation. But what's been interesting through this conversation is listening to you is, despite that, cooperation continues to charge ahead. It's still there, and there is still governance. It exists very, you know, within the United Nations. It exists very strongly still within the Arctic itself. And it's not been trying to hold on to a retrenchment, but you're saying, like, actually now we're still at a period now where the evolution has continued since those early days, where now it's common for Inuit to have a seat at the table, and it's expected, and you're not just, you know, a stakeholder or something like this. And so it's refreshing. It's been a refreshing conversation to see and feel that, you know, and realize, wait a minute, so things are still marching ahead where they may be retrenching in other places. Things are still marching ahead, and to remind us how far things have come, and how far Inuit rights and self-determination, Indigenous people's rights to self-determination, have come in just the past 20 or so years. So I really thank you, appreciate that. And I'm going to turn it over to Leonie, because I think she has, I'll give her, let her talk about personally, but also in Canada, you know, because reconciliation is top of mind for many.
I just wanted to turn to reconciliation for a bit, speaking personally as a student and non-Indigenous person. How can someone like myself, who wants to do the right thing and support Indigenous rights and the work of the ICC, be most helpful? Would you have thoughts or advice for non-Indigenous people who want to actively do their part, but don't necessarily know how to make a positive impact? There's obviously education, but going forward and beyond that, would you have any thoughts?
Well, this is also something that I thought a lot about, and especially with the development across all of the Arctic, the Nordic states, some of the Nordic states also have reconciliation and truth processes at this moment. And I live in a country, Greenland, which is part of a state, the Danish state, where this has not been dealt with in the same way that we have seen in Canada and that we are now seeing in, for example, Norway, Sweden. I have very often thought about what is it that is not there in our state, in our construction and constitutional arrangement between Greenland and Denmark, that there is that they have in Canada or they have in Norway and Sweden. I think that it's again, this is a very, very interesting development. In Greenland, we often through time and the latest decades since obtaining home rule in 1979 and self-government in 2009 have been focusing on taking responsibility of legislation, taking responsibility of different tasks in the society, making it very real to exercise the right of self-determination, because suddenly you decide on yourself how your health system should be, suddenly you decide on yourself how your education system should be, and so on. But that in the latest years has not erased the legacies, negative and positive, but mostly negative, that come up now of the colonization. And we have been struck quite hard by some of the information that has been revealed in the latest years, which suddenly makes it so relatable to see the truth and reconciliation processes that other nations have around us. And in answering your question, I want to tell you a little bit about that. One issue that has been revealed lately is the cases of that we call the IUD cases. So intrauterine devices being where half the current information we have is that half of the women and girls to the age of 12 in childbearing age in the end of 60s, beginning of 70s, were fitted with IUDs during a so-called IUD campaign led by the health authorities that were then under the responsibility of the Danish state. Why did it take so long for this information to be revealed? Why is it still so difficult to even talk about it in our own society? This really, really illustrates how deeply buried within every individual of us some of these things that stem from having been treated in a way that is actually inhumane, that is actually fully-fledged discriminatory based on our being as Indigenous peoples, how that has affected us as peoples, both collectively and individually. And I think that's one side of it, you know, realizing that in Greenland. The other side of it is realizing it in Denmark. And that has been a whole other story. So it's often said that, for example, Denmark as a colonial power has been viewed itself as one of the good guys. But with the reveal of these things, it really, I think, has challenged the way that Denmark as a state and collectively as a people think about themselves as a former colonial power and a current also power within a state where there's a constitutional arrangement which is not fully equal. So I think that development is going to be very, very interesting to follow, and it will be so important for our future that we also get to the bottom and do these things in a way that is careful for the people that it's about. And this is where I get to answering your question, where we can still look each other in the eyes and be respectful of each other, being knowledgeable of this each other's situations, and especially from that side who represent the former colonial powers or the ones with the majority of the power still today, that they have an ability to look inwards and reach a deeper understanding of what that role then was and what the effects of those historical things then have been to the people that we today would like to see being met on an equal footing, looking eye to eye on an individual level, right? So I think that it takes a lot of consideration and open-mindedness and even the ability to, in a Greenlandic setting even, being able to think twice of the things we've learned. The things we've learned in school, the things we've learned on how our structure is. This has also challenged us in Greenland to ask ourselves, but are we doing the things in the right way ourselves? Have we continued practices that were from the colonial era? And yes, we have, because we still find cases of IUDs having been inserted without the knowledge of the woman or the girl that go up in the era where Greenland had responsibility itself. So this is going to be a long and difficult process, but a necessary process to actually being able to stop and think and look inwards and try to reach a deeper understanding of why we do things the way we do. Is there things that we should think completely differently? Are there things we have learned that now sort of sit in us inherently and we think that's the way we should view the world when maybe we could view the world differently if we tried turning things around? So I think that's a lot to put on one student's shoulders. But I'm, you know, thinking of this in a more broad sense that each and every one of us individually, but also collectively as nations who have a relation and will have a relation in the future, that we actually also manage to look inwards and think about how we approach these different challenges and issues that we are going to face and are facing at this current time. So I don't know if that answers your question.
I think it absolutely does, because what I hear you saying at the end is basically it's for everyone. It's a collaborative project, and we all have to engage in a dialogue together to basically reflect and to question what we assume. It's a project for everyone to do together, and so it's something that we all can need to share almost in that process of asking questions, reflecting, thinking inward, thinking outward, how we want to build positive, strong relationships with one another.
And keep challenging ourselves in the way that we view the world.
Exactly.
And it's on both sides or all sides of the table to do that.
Never stop us questioning what we assume. Yeah.
Yes.
So, thank you. I think that's a perfect answer. And it's a helpful one. I think we can all take it away with us and now think about how to you know, what we could be doing in that spirit. So Sarah, I want to thank you so much for your time today. This has been actually excellent. I can't wait to distribute this on social media, because I think it's a really, you did an amazing job highlighting the importance of the Inuit Circumpolar Council, going back to its history, its present, thinking about the future. And so I think there's a lot for a lot of people, students, general people in society, intellectually curious people to listen to and reflect on and learn from our discussion today. So thank you. And thank Leonie as well.
It has been a true pleasure to speak with you. And hopefully some of the many words make sense.
So I look forward to being in touch and going forward and continue the great work. So thank you. Oh, and I will, do you want to lastly, is there like, what's the best way for people to learn more about Inuit Circumpolar Council? Maybe if you want to just give the website.
Yes, well, we have actually 3 different websites. So that's one of the things we are going to discuss at our delegates meeting, and how to strengthen our own internal structure, including what kinds of websites we have. But ICCAlaska.org has its own website, and InuitCircumpolar.com from ICC Canada, and Inuit.org from ICC Greenland. There's a lot of resources to find there about our organization.
Perfect. And could people find you there?
Yes.
If they want to follow up for any questions.
Yes, I should be on all of those 3 sites.
Mm. Okay. Perfect. Okay. Thank you so much. We appreciate it. And yeah.